This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show. At a meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences in 2011, researchers explained they wanted to find out whether the mafia's claims about sulfuric acid's effectiveness were true. As the forensics researchers told Science News, mafia informants made some big claims, such as, quote, "We put the people in acid. In 15 to 20 minutes, they were no more. They became a liquid," unquote. To test this idea, the scientists placed pieces of pig carcasses into vats of sulfuric acid and discovered that it took several days to dissolve the flesh. However, they did notice a difference when they added water to the sulfuric acid. In this case, it took a mere 12 hours for the muscle and cartilage to disintegrate. Whether the serial killer of today's podcast was the first person to ever use acid to cover up his gruesome deeds or not, he might just have been an inspiration to the killers who followed him. Between 1945 and 1949, serial killer John George Hay would claim six victims in London, England. Outwardly, Hay was a smart, charming, and good-looking entrepreneur. He would, however, ultimately be revealed as a cruel and calculating killer. Rather than becoming famous for any invention, Hay would instead achieve notoriety in the manner in which he disposed his victims, which would leave him in infamy as the acid bath murderer. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and welcome to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most infamous and notorious murderers. This is part two of our introspective into John George Hay, the acid bath murderer of England. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all in your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. At this point, I'd like to welcome my co-host, Vanessa. Vanessa will be providing insight into the psychology of serial killers. She's not a psychologist or psychiatrist herself, but she has done a lot of research on the subject.
Thank you, Greg. Glad to be back and excited to continue our exploration of John George Hay.
Now, in our first episode, we discussed Hay's secluded and highly religious upbringing, his difficulty finding long-term employment, several brushes with the courts, and stints in prison.
That's right. We talked specifically about narcissistic personality disorder, which includes, among its key traits, a severe lack of empathy for others.
We left off with Hay killing his first victim, William McSwan. What began with McSwan hiring Hay to work in his arcade would turn into what most who knew the pair considered a good friendship. During two of Hay's periods in prison, McSwan even visited. None of this mattered, however, on the day Hay decided to murder McSwan and dump his body into a 40-gallon drum of acid. Now, other than a few reports that Hay might have bullied students while in primary school, do we have any other evidence of his acting violently toward another person until his murder of McSwan?
Well, McSwan would mark for Hay a shift from relatively minor crimes, like fraud, to the ultimate crime of murder. Hay would never give an explanation for this escalation, though it seems the idea of murder originated while he was in prison. He also mentioned to a cellmate he'd never come back again. As far as we can determine, the motive for McSwan's killing was financial benefit.
Now, that's not one you hear every day when talking about serial killers, is it, Vanessa?
You're right about that, Greg. For Hay, at least from what we know now, murder was a means to an end. Serial killers are rarely motivated by profit. Sex, sadism, and/or power are much more common motivations. For most killers, it is the killing itself that is important to them. There's no evidence yet that Hay was interested in killing just to kill. Even his choice of weapon, a club, is also unusual. Stabbing and strangulation are more common because they allow a killer to kill slowly and savor each moment of power over their victim. Hay would seem to be most interested in getting the deed done and cleaning up.
I'm guessing the hours and days after a first killing would be a very critical time for a serial killer.
Yes, a killer's first victim answers a lot of questions. In the example of Hay, the first might have been, do I feel bad about this? Another might have been, did I get out of the killing what I wanted? From what we know of Hay, this would be answered by how much money would he get now that McSwan was dead. There's also, of course, am I going to get away with this? And was the acid successful at destroying the evidence?
Mm-hmm. Now, we know from our last episode that Hay felt nothing. Not remorse, not guilt, not anything, he said. That answers the question of whether Hay felt bad about killing McSwan. We also know from Hay that he was able to pour what remained of McSwan into the city sewer system. So in terms of his decision to use acid to dispose of the body, he was successful. The murder of McSwan would not be completed without some loose ends, however. Hay was well known to McSwan's parents, and as he had recently been spending time with their son, they would come to him first about William's disappearance. If Hay didn't have a good answer for them, it was likely his next conversation about William McSwan would be with police.
Hay was what we'd qualify as an organized serial killer. They're generally meticulous in their planning, and they're also usually highly intelligent. My guess is he had an answer worked out before he even ordered the acid. Let's not forget, a full month before killing McSwan, Hay rented out 3 bedrooms in the basement he would use to commit the murder. It's likely he looked at several places, carefully selecting a place where he knew he would not likely be disturbed. This was going to be his first attempt at murder. He didn't want to leave anything to chance. He ordered 6 pounds of muriatic acid and 2 10-gallon containers of sulfuric acid. Presumably, Hay ordered 2 different kinds because he was unsure which would be most suitable to his purposes of destroying McSwan's corpse. He would have also made sure there was a drain nearby, which would accommodate whatever remained of his victim.
A few days later, Donald McSwan did come looking for Hay, who told him that William had gone off to avoid being drafted into World War II. It was no secret to Hay or the McSwans that William would have done just about anything to avoid being drafted into the war. So Hay's explanation, at least at the time, raised no suspicions. In the weeks and months that followed, the McSwans would also receive several letters purportedly from their son. They were mailed from Glasgow and Edinburgh, detailing properties which he was considering for investment opportunities.
Wow, so not only did Hay lie about where McSwan had gone, he had also gone through quite a bit of work to fake correspondence to make the McSwans believe their son was alive and well.
Yeah, that's right. At the same time, using William's identification card, Hay began slowly emptying his old friend's bank account, taking £50 in January 1945, £35 in February, and £125 in March. Bank identification at the time did not have photographs. Hay merely needed to present the card he'd taken off William before placing him in the barrel of acid. It was assumed if you had the card, you were the name on the card. Without a photograph, bank tellers, police, or anyone else who might ask to see it would only have a limited physical description. As Hay and McSwan were about the same age and build, he wouldn't have had any problem assuming the dead man's identity whenever it suited him. Photographs were later introduced to help deter this form of identity theft.
From photo identification to live television and DNA identification, technology has come a long way in assisting police and federal authorities with their hunts for modern-day killers. During Hay's time, it would have been much more difficult to connect someone to a murder scene without a witness or a confession.
Though Hay had collected some money from the murder of William McSwan, he would discover too late that a majority of McSwan's assets, his business included, were being held in his parents' name. For months, Hay continued to try to sell people on investing in his idea for an automatic needle threading device, but he didn't have any luck. By June 1st, his bank account was overdrawn and he was unable to pay his hotel bill, so he gave notice that he'd be leaving. Hay again turned his thoughts to a more lucrative, albeit horrifying, plan.
We know that Hay didn't lose any sleep over his first victim. He acquired some money and got away with the crime. There was likely no reason in Hay's mind why he couldn't do the same thing again. It's scary to think that for Hay, this may have felt more like a chore.
In February 1945, Hay scraped together enough money to buy 3 barrels of sulfuric acid, 10 gallons each. Preparation had begun for his next, even more ambitious kill. His sights were on William's parents, Donald and Amy McSwan. Not only did the McSwans hold the deeds to their deceased son's home and business, but owned several rental properties themselves. But Hay would not take his next step until several months later, after receiving notice from his landlord that he would have to move out due to non-payment. 4 days before his July 6th move-out deadline, Hay appeared on the steps of the McSwan home. Despite having met them on several occasions previous, the doorstep was as far as Hay ever gotten. Hay gives no account of how he was able to get himself invited inside that day, though we could imagine that claiming to have news about their missing son William would have been sufficient. The only account of the final moments of Donald and Amy McSwan's life is Hay's.
"I took each separately to the basement, the father, Donald, and the mother, Amy, disposing of them in exactly the same way as the son."
Presumably by bludgeoning them as he did their son and dissolving them in acid, Hay would recall during his trial that the killing of Donald resulted in a lot of blood being spilled. It's possible that rather than a club, Hay had used an axe for this murder, as he reportedly gave an axe to one of the McSwans' neighbors. It would have taken a few days for the bodies to dissolve enough to pour the remaining sludge down the drain. By July 6th, Hay left the home. The empty barrels were collected by the supplier a few days later. Hay would say that it was not until the killing of Donald McSwan that he thought of using some form of mask, which he made out of a piece of tin, a strong tie, and lint. Hay had discovered that when acid eats away at a human body, terrible fumes are emitted.
So Hay was learning from experience. By this time, he knew how long the body would need to dissolve. It's possible that during the murder of William, Hay had to periodically check the barrel and perhaps even stir its contents until he could see the job was done. He knew now how long he needed and had even arranged to have the barrels removed after he was gone. It's likely he was feeling pretty confident about his methods.
The motive, it would seem again, was simply financial benefit.
Absolutely. Hay isn't totally alone in this. There are, of course, a few notable exceptions, like Eileen Warnos, for instance. She might sound familiar to our more frequent listeners. In Florida, between 1989 and 1990, she murdered 7 men by shooting them from point-blank range. She would say later that she needed the money to support herself and her girlfriend.
If you want to learn more about Eileen Warnos, check out our previous episodes where we dive into her mind.
But back to this killer.
Yes.
The McSwans had money and property, and Hay saw their deaths as an opportunity to take those things for himself.
Now, what about his choice of weapon? So far, a club or possibly even an axe? What does that tell us?
Well, many serial killers prefer to kill their victims slowly and therefore extend the experience. Stabbing and strangulation are common methods if gaining power is their goal. Hay's method thus far, again, suggests he was really more concerned about what he could get after they were dead. That's not to say that power isn't involved. Killing someone is the ultimate expression of achieving authority over another person. It is probable that Hay envied the wealthier McSwans. They were successful, and Hay was not. By killing them, Hay could prove to himself, at least, that he was better than they were.
Hay did gain much of the McSwans' wealth after the murders. Just how much? We'll talk about that after the break.
And now, back to serial killers.
Ultimately, the murder of William McSwan's parents would net Hay something in the range of £8,000. He began first by collecting rent from those living in homes the McSwans owned, and when that became tedious, Hay forged documents which gave him power of attorney. Hayes sold all of the McSwans' real estate holdings. With some of the money, he purchased a sports car, a green Armstrong Siddeley saloon. The following year, he traded up for the even more expensive Aston Martin Lagonda. These purchases not only facilitated his social activities and made him appear successful, but also meant that any future crimes could take place far away from where he lived. No one would make any serious inquiry or investigation into the McSwans' disappearance. They had no close friends or relatives who would have urged the police to do so.
Well, it's interesting to note that the McSwans did not fall into the more common categories of serial killer victims. The very young, the very old, the homeless, or prostitutes. The McSwans were middle-aged homeowners. Despite these differences, they did have something in common. No one was looking for them, as neither Mr. or Mrs. McSwan were salaried employees or had a close social circle. Their disappearance was not cause enough for alarm.
It should also be noted that their murder occurred during the final year of World War II. In these years, people came and left with little notice. It wouldn't have been out of the ordinary for someone with means to decide to move somewhere they felt safer. Around 1945, Hay had made the acquaintance of Edward Jones, managing director of Herslet Products, a light engineering plastics company. By 1947, the two men were engaged in the development of Hay's needle threading idea. With money stolen from the murdered McSwans, Hay invested £225 into the development of their prototype. As a form of security, Jones offered Hay a position in his company, which would include, most crucially, the use of a little-used storeroom in Giles Yard, Leopold Road.
I'm not sure I like where this is going. Hay's now gotten away with three murders. He's also showed increased confidence by deciding to go after both of McSwan's parents. Hay has a proven method for killing and disposing of bodies. The only significant challenge left was finding access to a private and remote location just outside of town to murder anyone willing to join him there. With his new arrangement with Jones, Hay might just prove to be unstoppable.
But by August, there was still no interest in his needle-threading invention, and Hay had no employment to speak of. Basically, he was broke again. Hay's position at the company would later be described as in name only. He drew no salary. But despite of his dire financial situation, he answered an advertisement for a property for sale by a couple named Henderson.
It would seem for Hay, at least in his imagination, nothing was ever out of reach.
Though Hay could not afford the house, it did not deter him from endearing himself to the couple. Hay would attend lavish parties at their house and even visit pubs with them on occasion. Hay describes in the following statement his feelings about the Hendersons as well as his other victims. This was the statement Hay gave police in 1949.
I found the Hendersons interesting and amusing, and we went about a good deal together. They used to like me to play to them, and for many hours I sat at their piano interpreting the classics. They had a dog, a red setter called Pat, to which I became greatly attracted. It reminded me of a puppy given to me by my father in boyhood. The Hendersons talked a lot of themselves, and from many conversations I learned a great deal about them. But we were never great friends. I never had any great affection for any of my eventual victims, though nor did I think they greatly trusted or respected me.
There's a lot going on here that we touched on in our discussion about narcissistic personality disorder. Hay's exaggerated sense of self-worth, his strong feelings of entitlement, and his improbable fantasies of success.
Yeah, like when Hay went to see the house they were selling even though he was broke.
Exactly. We're also reminded of the way Hay's parents looked down on anyone not a member of their church, and how they passed that trait on to Hay. Not only did Hay look down on other people, he was also suspicious of their motives and feelings toward him.
As in the case of the McSwans, Hay made his preparations carefully in advance of the murders. In late December of 1947, he again purchased three 10-gallon barrels of acid, which were brought down to the workshop in Giles Yard. He also obtained a 40-gallon drum, like the one he'd used to submerge his previous victims in acid. At some stage during this planning process, Hay stole Dr. Henderson's old service revolver, an Enfield No. 2 Mark I, and gas mask from their house at Dawes Road.
There's definitely an acceleration occurring.
Mm-hmm.
We also see Hay here learning from his previous killings. You'll remember that while killing Donald McSwan, Hay had said there was blood everywhere. He evidently didn't want to clean up that kind of mess again. Perhaps he had also gotten blood on his clothes before. A gun would give him more distance from the act and leave less physical evidence on him.
The Hendersons were last seen alive by hotel staff on February 12th. Hay's own diary is suspiciously blank for that afternoon, and he marked that day in the Hendersons' diaries with their initials and crosses, as he had done for McSwan in 1944.
Ooh, that just gave me chills. Mm. He went into the Hendersons' personal diaries and marked crosses on the date he killed them.
Yeah. We're not sure if this was done before or after the killings. This is another case of only having Hay's own statement to rely on.
I took Dr. Henderson to Crawley and disposed of him in the storeroom at Leopold Road by shooting him in the head with his own revolver, which I had taken from his property at Dawes Road. I put him in a tank of acid as in the other cases. This was in the morning and I went back to Brighton and brought up Mrs. Henderson on the pretext that her husband was ill. I shot her in the storeroom and put her in another tank and disposed of her with acid. In the case of Dr. Henderson, I removed his gold cigarette case, his gold pocket watch and chain, and from his wife her wedding ring and diamond ring, and disposed of all this to Bulls at Horsham for about £300. I paid their bill at the Hotel Metropole, collected their luggage and their red setter, and took the luggage to Dawes Road. The dog I kept for a period at the Onslow Court Hotel, and later at Gatwick Hall, until I had to send him to Professor Sorby's kennels in the country on account of his night blindness.
It's chilling how matter-of-fact Hay's statement sounds. Like with William McSwan, Hay had spent time socially with the Hendersons, yet he doesn't come across as having any remorse or compassion for his victims. We know from several research studies that serial killers have a sense of detachment from most of the world. We also know this detachment usually begins to develop at an early age. These killers often report what could be described as a feeling of uniqueness about themselves. This doesn't necessarily mean they feel positive about that uniqueness, only that the way they perceive the world is very different than the way they believe other people see the world.
Flush with money made from selling the Hendersons' property, Hay was able to pay his past due bill at the Onslow Court Hotel and move back in. He reportedly spent most of Christmas 1948 and the early New Year of 1949 attending parties as if he had not a care in the world. We don't know if Hay spent too lavishly over the holidays and was in need of money again, or if he just simply saw an opportunity he couldn't pass up. But just over a month later, on February 18, 1949, one of the Onslow Court Hotel guests where Hay was also staying was reported missing. Her name was Mrs. Olive Duran Deacon, a 69-year-old wealthy widow and 5-year hotel resident. In the coming days and weeks, Scotland Yard would expand their search from all open spaces and bombed sites around London to a wide-scale search of the heavily wooded countryside in the Crawley-Horsham district. Around this time, another guest at the hotel by the name of Mrs. Kirkwood told police that when she last saw Mrs. Duran Deacon, Duran Deacon had said she was going to meet Mr. Hay. They were to go to the place, quote, where he experiments on different things, unquote.
Hmm. Whether or not Hay had grown desperate or greedy, he'd certainly grown bold. Hay had chosen a victim whose disappearance would not go unnoticed for very long.
Hay was sitting in his sports car when a detective approached. Following a brief conversation, Hay accompanied the inspector to the police station in Chelsea. It would be a few days before police reported they were questioning 40-year-old John George Hay regarding Mrs. Duran Deacon's disappearance. Hay's account, as told to the police, was that he'd had an appointment to meet Mrs. Duran Deacon outside the Army and Navy store on Victoria Street, London, which she failed to keep. Hay told police he intended to take the old woman to his offices at Crawley, but after an hour of waiting, he gave up on her.
He certainly didn't have a problem coming up with elaborate lies.
The business venture, Hay told police he and Mrs. Duran Deacon were considering embarking upon, involved the manufacture of plastic fake fingernails. Hay said she'd presented the idea to him a week earlier.
From her acquaintance with Hay at the hotel, she knew he worked at a company which could produce her invention.
Whether Hay thought the idea was a good one or planned to steal it for himself, with the widow's murder and Hay's arrest, nothing would ever come of it. A German inventor was credited with the invention 5 years later.
After all those years of searching and trying to make a living deceiving people, he finally had a chance to make a fortune honestly, and he blew it.
Yes. Instead of pursuing what could have been a very lucrative business with Mrs. Duran Deacon, on March 2nd, 1949, Hay was being ushered into a courthouse to face charges of murdering her. Sightseers, bus conductors, and hundreds of women crowded the entrance that day for a look at this accused killer they'd been reading about in all the daily newspapers. Hay was described by one reporter as self-composed and an attentive listener. Hay wore a light brown tweed overcoat and red tie. His glossy black hair, well-oiled, was brushed back from his forehead. Vanessa, why do you think so many women turned out to see Hay's trips to and from court?
Well, in early murder cases, before television and movies, trials were very often attended for pure entertainment value. While some of the women who watched may have been interested to see for themselves the dashing man they'd seen photographs of in the paper, it's just as likely that they didn't have work obligations. The majority of women in 1950s London didn't have jobs.
On March 19th, nearly 2 weeks before the trial was officially set to begin, reports began to emerge that Hay was being linked by Scotland Yard to five other murders: Dr. Henderson and his beautiful wife, and a family with the surname McSwan. Rumors also circulated that Hay had disposed of all the bodies using acid. The trial would begin officially on April 1st, 1949, at Sussex Assizes before Justice Travers Humphreys. Hay was to be tried for only one murder, as was usual at the time. The prosecution was led by Sir Hartley Shawcross. He reminded the jury to forget everything they'd read in the papers or heard about the case previously. He gave an outline of the case as he saw it. Hay had access to a shed on Leopold Road. He had told Police Inspector Webb that, quote, "Mrs. Duran Deacon no longer exists. She has disappeared completely, and no trace of her will ever be found again," unquote. Hay was alleged to have admitted to destroying her in acid and asked how the inspector intended to prove murder without a body. Hay thought he could get away with murder. We'll look into this ego after the break.
And now, back to the story.
Clearly, Hay was feeling extremely confident. Hay believed that the police would find nothing in what remains were left to identify her, and because of that would be unable to meet the requirements known as corpus delicti, which translates to body of crime. In theory, if there's no body, there's no murder. There is an exception, however, which states that if there exists sufficient circumstantial evidence to suggest a murder has taken place, for instance, significant bloodstains in a missing person's home, a suspect can be charged with the crime.
30 witnesses were called by the prosecution, among them a Scotland Yard scientist, who testified that from the soil removed from Crawley Yard, his team found 28 pounds of a substance resembling melted body fat, part of a foot, and 18 fragments of human bone eroded by acid, as well as the full upper and lower dentures of a woman verified by a dentist as having been made for Mrs. Deacon. Inspector Webb would swear on the stand that in Hay's hotel room was a list in the accused handwriting, which had the name of a company which supplies oil drums of a kind similar to the 40-gallon container, inside which investigators had discovered the liquefied remains of Mrs. Duran Deacon. Also on the list were the letters H2SO4, the chemical lettering for sulfuric acid. And if that wasn't damning enough, there were gloves, a stirrup pump, an apron, a cotton wool pad, and some red paper. Basically, a shopping list to commit such a crime that Hay was being accused of.
The list seemed to indicate that Hay felt prepared to commit the perfect murder. Ironic that the one he planned for the most would be the one that might bring him down.
Mrs. Deacon, Hay's final victim, was last seen about 2:10 p.m. by a Mrs. Lang, who also lived in the Onslow Court Hotel. About 2:30, Hay drove Mrs. Deacon from the hotel to Crawley. Between 4 and 5 p.m., they went into the George Hotel Crawley and then drove away together in his car. What the prosecution claims Hay said happened next was that he took Mrs. Duran Deacon into the storeroom and shot her in the back of the head while she was examining some paper. He then removed her Persian lamb coat and her jewelry and looked inside her handbag and took what he thought was the only thing worth taking, 30 pounds in cash. Then he put the body of Mrs. Deacon into the drum, together with the handbag and the rest of its rather useless contents. Hay was reportedly back in his store later that day, and the following day he returned to the Onslow Court Hotel as if nothing happened. He asked proprietor Mr. Lane if Mrs. Deacon was ill. The next day, Hay returned to Crawley to find that the elderly woman's body was almost completely dissolved, Only a piece of fat and fragment of bone floating on the sludge was left. It's alleged that Hay then emptied the sludge into the yard. On the same day, Hay accepted an offer for some jewelry of 100 pounds cash and paid his business partner, Mr. Jones, 36 pounds of the 50 pounds Hay borrowed to pay his hotel bill. The prosecution then alleged that on February 28th, Hay had told police,
"Having taken her in the back of the storeroom at Leopold Road, I shot her in the back of the head while she was examining some paper for use as fingernails. Following that, I removed the coat she was wearing, a Persian lamb, and the jewelry, rings, necklace, earrings, and a cruciform, and put her in a 45-gallon tank."
Before the trial to even began, Hay had confessed not only to Mrs. Duran Deacon's murder, but also to the murders of Willie McSwan, McSwan's parents, and the Hendersons. Any thought on why he did this, Vanessa?
Well, as we discussed a bit earlier, as far as Hay was concerned, it didn't matter what he told the police, as much as it mattered that they would find none of his victims' bodies. And without those bodies, Hay believed he couldn't be found guilty. It's very likely as well that more than anything, Hay enjoyed telling the police about his exploits. He was showing off, bragging about how smart he'd been. After having kept the secret of his deeds to himself for so long, he may have even been excited to tell them. The murders were proof to Hay that he was smart and everyone else was stupid, even the police.
The forensics investigation led by pathologist Dr. Simpson examined the boxes of earth and sludge outside the small office. They found the handle of the elderly victim's red handbag, a lipstick container cap, and an intact full lower denture. There were human remains, 280 pounds of body fat, 3 gallstones, a hip bone, and parts of 17 other bones, all shown to be the remains of an elderly woman. The denture and gallstones survived because they were resistant to the acid. The denture was identified by Mrs. Duran Deacon's dentist. While Simpson could not say with certainty the cause of death, he did surmise the bloodstains on the wall suggested the woman had been shot, standing at the bench between two windows.
From our discussion of corpus delicti, we know that if there is enough evidence to suggest a murder, a body is not needed. Clearly, with Mrs. Duran Deacon's lower denture among those items discovered, as well as the blood on the walls from a gunshot, we can deduce that she had been murdered, and this was where the horrifying deed had been committed.
A paper at the time noted that if Hay had waited even a week before directing the police to his offices at Giles Yard, it's likely everything except Mrs. Duran Deacon's gallstones would have been destroyed by the acid. In which case, the police would have had a very difficult time proving that the sludge which remained had in fact been the former widow. Hay's impatience or overconfidence would be his undoing. In addition to evidence found at the crime scene, police would discover bloodstains on a cuff of one of Hay's shirts and Mrs. Duran Deacon's fur coat, which was found in Hay's car.
Sounds to me like the trial wasn't going to end as Hay had hoped.
Satisfied that they had presented an extremely strong case against Hay, the prosecution would rest. It was now time for Hay's defense attorney, Sir David Maxwell Fife, to make his opening statement.
With everything we've heard, my guess is there was only one defense he could make: insanity.
Yes, and that's exactly what Maxwell Fife did. Hay's attorney said that all the evidence which the prosecution had presented had only served the purpose of proving that his client, John George Hay, was insane when he murdered Mrs. Deacon Durant. Barrister Maxwell Fife asked for a special verdict of guilty of the act charged but insane at the time.
It's a good time to remind our listeners about the Minotin rule, which stated that every defendant should be presumed sane and responsible for his or her crimes unless the contrary could be proven. Hay's attorney would need to prove that his client, John George Hay, was laboring under a defect of reason and that he did not know what he was doing was wrong. Both very difficult challenges.
To help him do this, Maxwell Fife would call upon Dr. Henry Yellowlees. Yellowlees was one of the 3 psychiatrists who examined Hay before the trial and the only one who believed Hay might be insane. Yellowlees explained at the attorney's prompting that Hay's strict religious upbringing and the formative years in which he'd experienced dreams of a bleeding Christ were of crucial importance in explaining his current state of mind. Hay's lawyer stated that, quote, "paranoiacs, such as his client Hay, adopted savage practices. Vanessa, what is a paranoiac?
Well, that refers to a person who suffers from extreme paranoia, which is the belief that other people are conspiring to do you harm, despite any evidence to support this belief.
Hayes' attorney would continue to say that dreams had led his client to carry out Mrs. Duran Deacon's murder and the others, believing that by doing so, he was carrying out the desires of a higher authority. In conclusion, he said paranoia existed as a known mental condition, and that this abnormality had developed over the years into the extreme form they saw expressed in his client, John George Hay. Before we get to the verdict, I'd like to know, given what we've discussed over the last two episodes, what you think, Vanessa. Was Hay insane?
Well, first, let me say that I believe that Hay suffered from narcissistic personality disorder, definitely. Time and time again, he showed an inflated sense of his own importance, a deep need for admiration from others, and a total lack of empathy for others. Behind Hay's mask of ultra-confidence lay a fragile self-esteem, vulnerable to the slightest criticism, especially his own. To the question of insanity, as regards to the legal definition, I would say no. The crucial part for me in proving Hay was insane has to do with whether or not he knew what he was doing was wrong. To me, it's very easy to show that he did, by the mere fact of his disposal of the bodies in acid. Not only did he attempt to destroy what evidence he could of his victims, but he often planned this destruction out days and weeks in advance, ordering the barrels, the acid, the gas mask. To me, all this amounts to premeditation and a keen awareness that what he was doing would be perceived by the rest of the world as wrong, even if to Hay it wasn't.
Apparently, during most of the trial, Hay worked on crossword puzzles, which was where his attention was when the jury returned with the verdict. They found Hay guilty of the murder of Mrs. Duran Deacon. When the judge asked Hay if there was any reason at all the judge should not impose the sentence of death as prescribed by law, Hay replied without a seeming flicker of appreciation for the magnitude of the question he was being asked. He said simply, quote, "Nothing at all."
John George Hay, the sentence of the court upon you is that you be taken from this place to a lawful prison, and thence to a place of execution, and there you suffer death by hanging, and that your body be buried within the precincts of the prison in which you shall have been last confined before your execution. And may the Lord have mercy upon your soul.
Hay's trial ended July 19th. His execution would take place less than 3 weeks later at 9 in the morning on Wednesday, August 10th, inside Wandsworth Prison. The last person from outside the prison to see Hay was a reporter named Safford Summerfield. He had followed the trial from the beginning and visited Hay on only one earlier occasion since Hay's conviction. What follows is Summerfield's characterization of his final visit with the acid bath murderer, John George Hay. It was interesting, however, that in his last conversation with an outsider, he still stuck to his previously expressed view that he was not responsible for what he had done, but that he was moved and guided by some power outside of himself. To back up his theory, he quoted Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9, quote, "What is, and what is to be, will be," end quote. Just before 9 a.m., Hay was led to a small room with green shutters through which the scaffold was revealed. Hay did not make any final statement. Outside the prison gates, a crowd of 500 women, schoolgirls, and toddlers waited for the official notice to be affixed to the prison doors. In contrast, a killer executed a week later drew only 15 visitors. Once positioned over the trapdoor of the gallows, a bag was put over his head and a noose tightened around his neck. His legs were then tied together, and the trapdoor was released. Hay plunged through it. He was dead within minutes. And so, the acid bath murderer was no more. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network. As always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admeyer. Serial Killers is written by Scott Wilson and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing voice actor this week is Steve Pinto.